So I have been teaching this two-week retreat. And pretty much every day I've been giving a talk. And the talks for this retreat have been focusing on describing the Buddhist path in the most orthodox description of the path for Theravada Buddhism. Theravada Buddhism is the Buddhism of Burma, Thailand, and Sri Lanka. And there's many ways of describing the Buddhist path and Buddhist spirituality, but the one that has became, over the centuries, the one that's became, in some sense, the most influential for Theravada Buddhism is called the Seven Stages of Purification. And there's a big book called The Path of Purification that was written in the 5th century that kind of lays this out. And, you know, in ancient India, Buddhism, and still maybe to this day, Buddhism was not known as a religion. Partly because the word religion didn't exist back then. But, you know, it didn't call it religion. What Buddhism was called was a marga or a magga. It was called a path among paths, a magga among other maggas, a marga among other margas. And there were different paths being offered in India. Still to this day, people offer margas, offer paths. Some of you might be familiar with the term Ananda Marga, which was an Indian Hindu tradition that was popular, still around, but so they have a school in Palo Alto. And, or they used to. And so Buddhism is a path. And there are, within Buddhism, there are a number of variety of descriptions of that path and different opinions about what the nature of a path might be. But I'm fond of the idea that a path describes a development over time. And human beings have the capacity to develop themselves. And if you look at children, you see a natural development as they grow, as they develop their different capacities and understanding of the world. And there's a variety of things get developed in children as they grow. There's a sense of socialization, who they are in relationship to other people, how they're distinct from other people. There's a moral sense, moral development of children. There's a variety of things that develop over time. And there's no reason why this natural human development should be considered stopped at the age of 18 or 21. And actually, I think much of this kind of continues right up until time of death. And some of you who are old enough to look back over a long adult life will probably recognize that you've also changed and developed in the course of your adult life. So the idea of a spiritual path in Buddhism is not only to leave your development to chance, but it could also be directed or set on a particular path. If you don't choose the path you're going to be on, then the natural development of human beings will follow whatever path is close by and available. And so some of us in this culture here, the path of development is maybe not so, that's offered by our culture, is maybe not so healthy for everyone concerned. There's path of consumption. For example, some people love us to become better consumers. And so people become better consumers over time, perhaps, and go into debt. I see it in my younger son is in kindergarten here in the public school in Redwood City. And it's kind of interesting for me to watch how they are teaching the kids from day one in kindergarten. And they have this. The kids are given this little journal, simple little journal, that has each page has one sentence with a blank word, and then they can draw big lots of blank space, so they can do drawings. And each day they come to class, or someone reads. They can't read. Someone reads the sentence, and the kids have to fill in the blank and then write the word. And most of these sentences start with are something like. My favorite color, my favorite toy is, my favorite food is, my. And I've read about Japanese coming to America and putting their kids in kindergarten and horrified by this approach to raising children, this emphasis on the self. And how the other thing they do in kindergarten is they have Star of the Week week. In the course of the year, every kid gets to be the star of the week. And, you know, 1 week of the course of the year. Now, what does that do to a little five-year-old? That kind of prominence, it's supposed to, in some schools of psychology, it's supposed to create a stronger sense of self, self-esteem, and all this. But as we've now learning, the whole self-esteem movement of the 1980s and 90s is kind of backfiring. And people are realizing that this maybe wasn't such a good thing for some of these young people as they grew up. So, you know, there is a path, you know, development that's offered, and if we don't give it some conscious thought to how we're doing it, what direction we're going, society will offer it for us in various ways, and maybe it's not really to our benefit. So Buddhism offers a path, and there are a number of different descriptions of this path. And the fact that there are a number of different descriptions means that we can hold them lightly. We don't have to think of it, this is a, take it too literally. Some people follow these paths kind of step by step. Some people follow them backwards. Some people follow them upside, you know, sideways. Some people jump over big pieces of it. Some people just jump right to the end and say, what path? But there is a path that is classically offered. So there are seven stages to this path. It's called the path of purification. It's a process of purification. Some people in the West, when they hear the language of purification, get quite cautious around it, or maybe even aversive to it, because it reminds them of certain kind of puritanical approaches. Need to turn it up a little bit, I think. A certain kind of puritanical approaches that, I guess Puritan means pure, right? So that exists here in the West. And so it kind of then has connotations that somehow you're sinful. And people's kind of caution arises pretty quickly around the word purification. The idea of purification in Buddhism is a emptying, a simplification, a cleansing of those things inside of us that cause suffering, both to ourselves and to others. So there are inner forces of greed and hate and delusion which, when they're operating, can cause suffering to ourselves and can cause suffering to others. And if we allow these things to kind of keep operating uncleansed, unpurified, unresolved, unchecked in some way, it becomes a dangerous world to live in. And there's quite a contrast, you know, between the greed, the hate of the Burmese dictators, the military there, which is quite dramatic. When I was in Burma, the stories I was told of the torture and the way, the gruesomeness of what was going on there was quite dramatic. And the contrast to the monastic monks and nuns of practice, where there's a tremendous amount of goodwill, where greed, hate, and delusion is not the operating, and fear is not the operating approach, but it's, you know, they're purified of that. So in Burma, it's very, very dramatic, that contrast. So, the first two stages of purification, or cleansing, or emptying of that which is extra and not needed in our life, is something which is shared, I think, by many religions. It's not unique to Buddhism. The last five can be considered more unique to the path of vipassana, of insight meditation. So the first has to do with the purification of virtue, purification by virtue. And this also can raise puritanical worry about any emphasis on virtue. But one of the understandings of virtue in Buddhism is that you want to create the conditions so that you can feel good about yourself. So that when you sit down to meditate, there's a feeling of coming home to something which is enjoyable or good or wonderful here. And if a person doesn't have moral integrity, then it's a little bit hard to sit down and feel good about what's going on here. And so I've seen people for whom sooner or later, their lack of moral integrity catches up to them when they meditate. And even if they don't want to look at that part of their life, sooner or later when you sit down to meditate, meditation is a process of becoming whole. And moral integrity, disintegrity, lack of integrity, has to do with being fragmented. And so as we kind of begin becoming more whole, we tend to encounter the places where there's lack of integrity. And it's hard to feel good about ourselves. So one of the purposes of virtue in Buddhism is to create a good feeling here. And primarily in this first purification, by purifying our behavior. Part of the idea here is that our behavior is easier to rectify than our mind or our hearts. So we start where, you know, because it's gross behavior. So we start there, and we look at our behavior, and we try to not, beat people up. And so if we've been beating people up, having slug fights regularly, we stop doing that, because that's, you know, a lot easier to control your fists than your mind. So Buddhists try to live by the five precepts: not to kill, not to take what is not given, not to engage in sexual misconduct, not to lie, and not to intoxicate oneself. So again, not so much because it's this puritanical thing to do, but rather, if we want to create a good vessel here, in our body and heart and mind, for doing the deep inner work that meditation is going to call for, you want to kind of at least have your behavior set so your behavior feels good. You feel comfortable about your behavior, how you live in the world. You might have been unethical in the past. That certainly should be looked at a little bit. But Buddhism tends to encourage you not to get lost in what you've done in the past. Make amends, do what needs to be done. But rather be content that if you've made a resolve from now to be ethical, be happy for the decision you've made now. Or if you go on retreat and you're living an ethical life on the retreat, at least feel content and happy about that. So rather it's more forward looking. From now on, this is how I'm going to live. And then feel good about it. You're encouraged to feel good about having made that decision, as opposed to getting hung up of how you've acted in the past. Because being hung up doesn't help this process. So the first is the purification of virtue. The second is the purification of mind. Now, behavior is easier to rectify or purify or work with than mental forces. So this is going to be the next step, which is harder to do. And here, this is understood to involve concentration meditation, to develop one's concentration. Perhaps here in the West, Western psychological culture, in order to feel good about ourselves, to create a clean, nice vessel here for the development of the inner life, maybe psychotherapy is helpful for that process. Maybe that involves some of this purification of mind that the Buddhists do through concentration meditation. Concentration meditation is very powerful. And in order to develop concentration, people have to kind of encounter a lot of the inner forces in their life that keep them fragmented, keep them from being present, and keep them somehow agitated. And so, for example, one of the tasks of this stage of purification is to overcome the forces of the mind that keep you preoccupied in the past or in the future or in fantasy. And maybe you don't realize how much you're preoccupied in those places until you sit down to meditate. And then, wow, I had no idea I could spend so much time planning. I had no idea that I was so driven to always be thinking about the past in some way, or thinking about the future, or just being lost in fantasy. So then there's this inner development that has to happen, that where we learn to let go of these things, these concerns, and we learn to focus the mind here and now on the present moment. So the purification of mind starts with this beginning to bring the mind into the present moment. For this to happen, it really helps if the mind, this little mind of ours, has a really good understanding of the value of being present. If it doesn't understand that it's more valuable for you to be present than to be in the future and the past, why would it want to do it? But so there has to be some analysis, some wisdom around that's really useful. And there's a lot to be said about that, but for now I'll say one thing. That to be alive is a marvelous thing. It's a rare thing. And for you to be alive is a relatively rare thing. And it doesn't take long to realize, to kind of go through kind of the history of your father's, you know, and your mother's sperms and eggs and how they met each other, and realize that easily it could have been another parallel universe, right? If it had been a different sperm, a different month, you know, it could have been, you could be a really different person. And, or if your parents had, you know, had met other people first, you know, we'd all be here except for you. And who knows where you'd be. And so for this particular person of you to be here now is really an amazing thing. And then to be alive, you know, how long do you have to be alive? In the span of time, it's a blink of an eye. And so if being alive is precious, where are you really alive? Where does that happen? Is it going to happen in the future? Maybe it's going to happen in the future. Who knows? But it does not happen in the fantasy about the future. Did it happen in the past? Yeah, all of you have a past. But remembering your past is not living the lived life. That's remembering the lived life. The lived life happens here. And Buddhism emphasizes the lived life. And as we enter the lived life, the opportunities in the lived life become available to us. And there's a variety of opportunities that spiritual teachings point to that are available only if you're here. So the first task of this purification of mind is to understand the value of being present. And the second is to train the mind to start being present. Then as we start being more present, one of the things we encounter is those forces in the mind that obscure and make it difficult for us to really encounter the present moment in a full, clear way. The Buddhist tradition calls these the five hindrances, the five obscurers. If you have a beautiful pond, lake, let's say an alpine lake, and it's completely still and there's no wind, and you know, you can look at that beautiful reflection of the mountain in the lake, or you can look right into the lake and you see right to the bottom. However, if someone puts red dye into the lake, then you don't see clearly. You see it through the filter of the red dye. If someone heats up the water in the lake and it starts boiling, and then it's so much boiling water on top, it doesn't create a nice reflection. It doesn't let you see deeply in. If someone lets lots of algae and, you know, sludge and stuff, moss grow in the lake, then you can't see either. And to try to go through it or kind of clear the lake so you can see something is really hard and messy and slow work. You know. Or if a huge wind whips up the surface of the lake, then you know, there's all these waves and stuff, and also again you can't see. Or if the rain comes along and washes a whole bunch of mud into the lake, and the lake's all muddy and, you know, you don't have a clear lake anymore. So those analogies are used for the five hindrances. If the mind is in the grip of desire, the first hindrance, it's like having rose-colored glasses and we can't really see what's really here. If the mind is in the grip of ill will or anger, it's like the mind is boiling. And again, you can't really see the mind very clearly. You can't reflect what's going on in the world very clearly either. If the mind is lethargic, bored, resistant to what's going on, it's like how this heavy, you know, algae is covering the clarity of the mind. And then if we're agitated and restless, it's like all this wind whipping up the surface of the mind. So again, the mind can't really see what's going on. Or if you're filled with doubt or uncertainty, trepidation, then it's like the mind is full of mud and you can't really make progress. So this purification of mind has to do with somehow working through these hindrances. So these hindrances are no longer obscure our ability to see clearly. So they don't obscure our ability to contact reality in a direct, unmediated way. So the mind becomes a clear instrument for meeting our reality, seeing what's here. So the first task is to be here. The second is, once we're here, the second task is to somehow clean the windows of the mind so the mind can see clearly what is here. So these two stages are shared by many different religions. And they're very powerful stages, and they can involve a tremendous amount of self-learning and transformation, especially the concentration part. Sometimes a tremendous amount of inner, it can take years for people to do the inner work, to work through a lot of the complex psychological forces that govern us, drive us, and keep us from being settled. They keep us fragmented. But once we've managed, at least temporarily, to overcome all these forces of hindrances, then we start the path of insight meditation. And the first stage of insight meditation is called the purification of view. View means kind of the purification of your perspective. How you look, what you look for when you look at reality. Once I went to IKEA, never wanted to go back again. And I went into this big furniture store, and was walking around this big furniture store, and it's kind of, after a while I realized it's like a maze. And after a while I realized I don't want to be here. And then the question was, how do I get out? So I don't know how someone told me or if I kind of figured out, but I was pointed to, there's this line on the floor, like a yellow line, is it? And this line on the floor, follow that line, the yellow brick line, follow the line. And then, you can follow it, it takes you around and around. It takes a lot of trust to believe this line's going to take you out, but eventually it takes you out. So in order to find your way out, you had to shift your perspective, my perspective, from the beds and the couches and the table and all this stuff that is mesmerizing, and actually look at something else, which is the path. Look at where it is. So it's a reasonable thing in life to somehow change our perspective, change what we focus on, so we can find our way. So this purification of you begins with a changing our perspective about what we look at, how we look at our life, with the idea that some of the usual perspectives we have are not so useful, maybe not even accurate. So the perspective that's offered in when we start the practice of insight is to see that there are two things always going on. There's our experience, and it's the mind that knows that experience. So there's a kind of a distinction that's made. In concentration practice, that distinction tends to fall away, and it's more like become one with the deep concentration practice, you become one with what you're focusing on. In insight meditation, you start teasing apart or seeing that there are two different things going on. There's the experience, and there's a knowing that you're having that experience, and all the things connected to knowing. Maybe it's a little bit the distinction between hearing and listening. You can hear something, but when you listen, there's a little active activity in your part, intentional part, where you're actually engaged in listening. So there's what you're listening to, and then there's listening, the mind that listens. The two different things. And if there's no sound, and you're trying to listen, the only thing going on is your part, the mental part. When you hear, then there's a two parts going on together. So there's these two things that are distinguished. And so teasing apart, this is very important. It's connected to teasing apart also our interpretation of experience from an experience itself, what it is. And as probably most of you know, it's very easy to have an interpretation of events, of what's going on in the present moment, that's not accurate. You're waiting on the corner of 32nd and 3rd Street for your friend. Your friend is late. And how could your friend be so late? This no good, lousy friend who's always, you know, standing you up. Here you are, this is really disrespectful. You're going to give your friend a good word. This is really terrible. Finally, you check the original note that says, you know, and it doesn't say 32nd and 3rd, it says 33rd and 2nd. And you realize that you build up this whole interpretation about what this event meant, where you actually had the faulty information. Or maybe you had the right information, but you find out that your friend actually tried to be there on time, but was in an accident on the way there. And so suddenly all your anger and your interpretation, this being disrespectful, falls away. So a very important part of Vipassana is being able to distinguish between the interpretation and what's actually going on. What's going on is you're standing on 32nd and 3rd. It's a sunny day. You have this appointment to meet someone. The person's not there. That's all kind of what's happening. Then there's an interpretation over that. This means that. So that starts, it can start with very gross, very large kind of things like that. But it also gets closer and closer to the moment-to-moment experience in meditation. So, for example, you're sitting and in meditation, and you might have an itch. And the mind says, this must be skin cancer. And I need to find a doctor. And the mind gets involved in interpretation. Just an itch. You're sitting watching your breathing. And as you're breathing, your breath is kind of shallow. What's happening is a shallow breath. The mind then interprets this. This is a symptom of psychological ill health. This must be someone who's really uptight, who has a shallow breath. I don't belong in California. So there's layers of interpretation on top of this. You know, it's just a shallow breath. And then there's, you know, concepts that go on top of that. So as we enter this world of insight, we're beginning to tease apart concepts, interpretations from the actual experience. And as that gets closer and closer, then we see more and more clearly that there is an experience and there's a knowing of it. It's very simple. There's an experience of pressure, and there's a knowing there's pressure. There's a sound, there's a knowing of hearing the sound. There's a thought, and you know you're having that thought. There's a feeling, and you know you have that feeling. The knowing is not the same thing as the feeling. The knowing is not the same thing as the thought. And that distinction becomes a very important one for Vipassana practice. And this is called a purification of view, a perspective. So you're pointed, look at this difference. See if you can see it in your experience. The next purification is purification of doubt. And this is a very important one because as we begin separating out our experience this way, one of the things that, one of the concepts we tend to overlay on our experience is the concept of self. Me, myself and mine. And it seems innocent enough, but it's still an activity of mind that overlays our experience with an idea, a concept. Sometimes it's more or less an accurate concept, you know, the itch is my itch. But even the activity of saying this is mine is an activity of mind which sometimes obscures really being able to see clearly what is actually going on here. And so people can have a lot of doubt when they enter this world of the direct experience, because where is the self? Where am I in it? When you start realizing I as an interpretation. And so part of this is to kind of shed the doubts that we might have that allows us to shed the interpretation of self that we overlay on experience. So again, we can see more clearly what is actually here. One of the things that gets overcome in this purification of doubt, or one of the things that happens, is we start seeing the cause and effect relationship between things. When you start seeing the difference between experience and the mind, you can see, for example, that there's an itch, and that itch is a condition for thinking about cancer. We can have, hear a sound and see that's a condition for, you know, if it's a loud sound, condition for maybe the shoulders tightening up. We can see the arising of a thought, and we can see that's a condition for tightening of the belly. We can see there's this cause and effect relationship. And what's really amazing is you get closer and closer, you can see how much of this happens without any direction from you, without any willing, any intentionality. In Buddhism, we say it happens selflessly. And it's amazing how much of our experience happens selflessly. You're sitting, you're very quiet and pay attention, I feel cold. I walk into some place where it feels cold, and the body tightens up a little bit. It wasn't willed. It wasn't chosen by ourselves. It's selfless in the sense that it wasn't a decision to tighten up. And we walk into the sun, and we relax. We see, oh, that's, you know, wasn't willed. It's just kind of nature of how things are. We hear a bell. If you're on retreat at 12 o'clock, you hear a bell, and you think lunch. And in retreat, that's when the lunchtime is, 12 o'clock. So it's kind of it wasn't a choice you made to think lunch. It just kind of popped up in the mind. Buddhism would say it's a selfless activity of the mind to have this word, this concept lunch appear. So start seeing how much things happen selflessly. And if you're on retreat in deep meditation and you tease apart the layers and layers of concepts we live under normally, then it's amazing how much of our experience and what goes on in us happens in a selfless way. The next purification is called a purification. Boy, 2 minutes to finish. It's a long path. The next is a purification of what is and what is not the path. And this is a very important one, because as people get into meditation practice and get deeper and deeper, they start having spiritual experiences. And this is the part of the path we understand, that having spiritual experiences is not the path, not the purpose. It can happen as you go along, but there can be a great experience of luminosity, of light. There can be great experiences of bliss and joy. There can be great experiences of knowledge, of understanding. People can have amazing understanding of life and themselves. And this is it, I understand. I'm the Einstein of spiritual Buddhism. There can be great experiences of faith and confidence. There can be great experiences of effort and energy. Just you feel like you're like this tremendous flow of energy and effort that seems selfless and dynamic, and just feels, this is it, I must have arrived, this is enlightenment. There can be great states of mindfulness. There can be great states of equanimity. There's a variety of wonderful things that we call spiritual experiences. No spiritual experience is it for the Buddhist path. And very important to not cling to any of these experiences, because clinging is not the path. The core definition of the path in Buddhism is that path that leads to non-clinging. So if you cling to something, it's not the path. And non-clinging is not an experience. It opens a door to a variety of experiences if you don't cling. But non-clinging is not an experience. So when you realize that the path is found in non-clinging rather than the spiritual experience, then you've attained the purification of what is and is not the path. Once you've done that, the next purification is called purification of practice. And this is that just you do the practice. Do the practice day in, day out. Just keep doing it. And as you do this, the practice begins purifying us. It's like purifying gold and heating it up and the dross comes out. Just doing the practice, day in, day out. You know what the practice is. You just keep doing it. As we do this, greater insight occurs. And the primary insights of the insight, you know, the insights for insight meditation is insight into the impermanent nature of phenomena. It's one of the key ones in our tradition. Also, the selfless nature of all phenomena. Very important for us. When the purification of practice has gone along far enough, then at some point there is the purification of what's called knowledge and vision. The purification where the mind finally releases the last vestiges of clinging. And there's a real knowing of the mind that's free of clinging. And with that, and that knowing is direct and immediate. That's why the idea of vision is connected to it, knowledge and vision. But the idea of vision, I think, for me is very important also. Because with the experience of awakening that can occur, there arises a vision. And at various points along the practice, probably many of you have had some kind of experience, that gives you a vision of a possibility, of a capacity you have. You've tasted it, you've intuited it, you had a glimpse of it, and it shows you that it's possible to integrate this freedom more fully into the rest of your life, into the fullness of your life. That there is this, you have this vision of a possibility. That if this practice can lead you further into the full integration of liberation and freedom. So that it's not something that's separate from who you are. So that that the inner processing of your life and the freedom of the mind become one and the same. Early in the stages of awakening, there can be a difference between a mind which is selfless, which is purified, which is clear, which is in some sense independent of experience, and then the inner processing of our personality, of our old habits and all that. And there can be a lot of freedom in seeing, well, these old habits and stuff are not really of freedom, but they still operate. Buddhism is not content with letting those operate with the mind, kind of somehow overarching mind, kind of free. But it wants to somehow bring these into harmony so that the inner personality becomes the awakened mind. The awakened mind becomes the personality, in a sense. So then, after this purification of knowledge and vision, there's a vision of what's possible. And then the practice continues. And the practice continues. Until this work of harmonizing or bringing to completion is completed. So we say that before realization, we practice. After realization, we practice. Practice, practice, practice. And so rather than focusing on an experience or even on realization, it may be more important to keep just focusing on practice, to entrust ourselves in practice, trust the practice, devote ourselves to practice. Just keep practicing. Practicing the honesty, the non-clinging, the compassion, which defines the path. And if we ever get to the end of the path, great. If we don't get to the end of the path, it's been a good life. It's been a good practice. Practicing honesty, non-clinging, and compassion, that's pretty good. It's a pretty privileged thing to do, to be able to spend one's life doing that. So this famous book called The Path of Purification lays out this path, the seven stages. It begins, the whole book begins with a poem. And it goes, the inner tangle, the outer tangle. This whole world is tangled in a tangle. Who is it that can untangle the tangle? And this whole big book, these seven stages of purification, describes how this untangling is done. So may you all get disentangled so you can tango. Thank you.